A smelly and possibly hazardous algae is creeping up the Caribbean. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It's called sargassum. It's brown and has a distinct odor, and it's piling up on beaches in the Caribbean and parts of South Florida.
It can cause seagrass die-off, fish kills, and even die-off of endangered species like sea turtles.
We'll learn more about this other algal problem. Also, students and staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas will be going back to school soon, many of them dealing with something known as communal trauma. We'll talk with a specialist who worked with groups after Sandy Hook and 9/11. And Miami-Dade Fire Rescue started a venom treatment program 20 years ago. It's the only one of its kind in the country, but now it's facing cuts. What happens now if someone's bitten by a poisonous snake? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. If you've been to the beach recently, you probably noticed this massive pile of brown seaweed that's lining the shores. It's an algal bloom called sargassum, and it's becoming much more than just a smelly nuisance to beachgoers. The blooms have exploded across the Caribbean, devastating the tourism industry, fisheries, and even producing toxic gas that can be harmful to humans. Sargassum is increasingly becoming a problem in South Florida's mangroves along the Keys, and the problem is only expected to get worse. Florida Atlantic University professor of biology and physiology, Dr. Brian LaPointe, has been studying sargassum for more than 30 years. He argues this year's bloom could be among the worst we've ever seen globally. I spoke with Dr. LaPointe from the studios of WXEL in Boynton Beach, and we started by talking. I asked him to explain the dangers of this year's bloom.
This is what you could call too much of a good thing. Sargassum at natural levels is beneficial. And naturally, sargassum is like a fish factory. We all know here in Florida, we go offshore and troll along the weed lines for mahi-mahi. It's just this amazing community of fishes and invertebrates, over 200 species that are associated with this floating vegetation. So, you know, historically, this has been a very positive thing when it comes ashore on the beaches in moderate amounts. It actually can help nourish the beach and build the beach. The problem that we're seeing increasingly, and this has really been happening mostly since 2011, is that excessive amounts of sargassum are coming ashore, and not just on the beaches, but in the mangroves, in our seagrass beds, canals and bays and harbors, where because of the excessive biomass, it's creating dead zones, areas devoid of oxygen, which will eliminate fisheries habitat. And it can actually get worse. It can cause seagrass die-off, fish kills, and even die-off of endangered species like sea turtles.
How about to humans? Is there a risk, a danger to humans if we come in contact with it?
Well, one issue that hasn't been a big problem in Florida, but it has in the Caribbean region, is the production of hydrogen sulfide, a toxic gas that, as this biomass sits and rots, the oxygen goes down, and in that environment, sulfur bacteria form hydrogen sulfide. And that is toxic, highly toxic. And so I know a lot of the islands now are having to monitor the levels of hydrogen sulfide that is associated with these areas that are seeing massive influx of sargassum.
So, Dr. LaPointe, how large is the sargassum bloom that we're currently seeing in South Florida?
The bloom in South Florida this year is, I would say, moderate. And compared to what's happening in the Caribbean, it's really probably minor. But it has caught the attention of the resource managers and the beachgoers who at times are having a hard time finding a place to put their umbrella or blanket on some of our beaches.
All right, so let's describe to people, because people have seen it and they probably smelled it and didn't realize it, but what exactly is sargassum?
Sargassum is a brown seaweed that is the namesake for the Sargasso Sea, which is the central gyre of the North Atlantic Ocean. And it was first really discovered and described by Columbus and his sailors in 1492 when they were sailing to the New World. And it reminded them of grapes, and the Portuguese sailors named it Salgazo after the Portuguese word for grape. And the translation today, of course, is Sargasso. And sargassum. And so it has a long history, and it's something that I've been studying for, over 3 decades now.
How does it differ from other algal blooms that we're seeing, especially the ones out of Lake Okeechobee?
Well, sargassum is a brown seaweed, so it's macroscopic. You can, pick it up. Some of the individual plants are as big as, say, a basketball, and then they fragment, and it grows from these little fragments into large plants again. So it has no sexual reproduction. It grows by vegetative fragmentation. The blooms we're seeing in Lake Okeechobee are cyanobacteria. These are single-celled algae, much smaller. You can see them with your naked eye, because they do form thick mats on the surface as they form these blooms. But they are comprised of single cells as opposed to sargassum, which has differentiated tissue and is a much more highly evolved alga.
We've obviously been talking about how those algal blooms from Lake Okeechobee are impacted by the warming seas and climate change, and obviously all the nutrient dumping that we've been doing from, developments and agriculture. Is sargassum the same way? Is it impacted the same way?
We think so. We think what we're seeing here in Florida and beyond, and the problem is much worse in the Caribbean region right now, we think that we are beginning to see the effects of increased nitrogen inputs to our oceans beyond our coastal zones out into the blue water environment, or the more oceanic realm, where sargassum ordinarily grows.
I'm speaking with Dr. Brian LaPointe. He's a researcher at Florida Atlantic University, the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute in Fort Pierce. They focus on algal blooms. For the past few decades, he's examined sargassum, an algae that exploded along Florida's coast and across the globe in recent years. I'd imagine, at least for, for industries that depend so much on beaches and tourism, this could be a nightmare. But maybe for you as a researcher, this is a good time because there's so much more.
I do look at it as job security. I think the algae are not going to go away. And if you look at the population growth on our planet and what's now happening with sargassum, that we are now seeing what we loosely term as a harmful algal bloom out in the open ocean, that this is not going to go away anytime soon. It looks like these sargassum blooms that have been worsening pretty much year by year since 2011 are not a one-off event. And we've been thinking that, well, maybe this is just a bumper crop this one year due to, say, climate change. Maybe extreme weather and rainfall one year might bring a lot of nitrogen down the Mississippi River, for example, and create, a bumper crop of sargassum in the Gulf of Mexico that might come ashore on Texas beaches. And that happened in 2014. But when you look at the trend that it is worsening, and this is the worst year yet, that it's not looking good that the sargassum is going to go away.
At the beginning, you told me that what we're seeing in Florida is moderate, but that, right, that this is, we've seen the worst year yet. So what are the trends telling you? Is this just going to get worse?
The trends are telling us that this problem is worsening. And luckily in Florida, we have not seen the worst of it yet, like the Caribbean region. It is having catastrophic effects in the Caribbean. There have no capacity in the Caribbean to deal with the massive biomass of sargassum that is, you know, stranding on the beaches, several meters high as far as the eye can see. There is just no way to physically remove that much seaweed from the beach. And it's having very adverse effects on the local ecosystem. So it's affecting environmental health as well as human health. Some of the homes near the bays and harbors where this influx is coming in, the residents are having to evacuate their homes because of the toxic hydrogen sulfide fumes that are coming off the sargassum, and it's causing it. Just there was just a report of a massive fish kill. I think the largest fish kill yet off Cancun, where again massive amounts of sargassum came ashore and depleted the oxygen, causing this large fish kill, the largest they've seen yet. So the trend, unfortunately, seems to be worsening. And I think the sargassum is telling us something we really need to know as humans, that maybe we're living beyond our means in terms of our human nitrogen footprint. And, of course, we've heard a lot about carbon and climate change and global warming. I think it might be signaling us that we need to also start talking about reducing our nitrogen footprint.
Dr. Brian LaPointe, he's a researcher at Florida Atlantic University at the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute in Fort Pierce. Again, a focus on algal blooms. We've been talking about this growing issue of sargassum, this algae that is exploding on Florida coast, but it's even worse, as he's told us, in the Caribbean. Dr. LaPointe, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can find more information on the sargassum blooms from WLRN and NPR by going to our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, the students and staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas may be struggling with communal trauma. We're going to explain what that is and how to treat it. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
And I'm Sammy Mack, the health reporter here at WLRN.
Well, staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas will have the unique opportunity this week to speak with a leading expert on the psychology of communal trauma. Deb Delvecchio Scully is a professional counselor and a motivational speaker.
And throughout her career, she's worked with survivors of the 9/11 terror attacks and the survivors of the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School. Delvecchio Scully understands communal trauma as a unique psychological experience and is teaching MSD staff and therapists the nuances of treatment.
The classes this Friday and Saturday are free to South Florida therapists and to the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas staff, and we will have more information available on our website for interested therapists. Delvecchio Scully joins us now via Skype. Ma'am, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me. So, great to be here.
Let's start with this. What is communal trauma, and how is it unique from other kinds of trauma?
Communal trauma is something that occurs that impacts most of the people in a geographical area. And that could be a relatively small area, or it could be worldwide, and similar to the effects of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. There are unique characteristics to this kind of an event. Generally, there's a location where it occurred, but because of the ripple effects, so when we talk about a school shooting, it is not only those that are within the school, certainly they are the primary people that are impacted, but it is everyone that loves them, everyone that works with them. It's every child, brother, sister, parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle, friend. And more school shootings in particular, tend to have an enormous ripple effect in some situations because of social media, but just because of the horror and the epidemic that we face in the United States.
I wanted to get the sense that, you know, just to bring it down, is it's a traumatic event that happens, but it impacts more than one person. But it's beyond the I think what I'm gathering from what you're saying, it's beyond just the people who were there. It's also a lot of other people connected to them.
Absolutely. And while that could happen with an individual personal trauma, the scale of the event is much larger than that. The impact of the event is much larger than that.
And what are some of the signs that somebody is experiencing the effects of communal trauma?
Anxiety, fearful anxiety, a sense of being on high alert, kind of waiting for the next bad thing to occur. They can also experience something that we call dissociation, or feeling disconnected from themselves, from their body. An example, a client said to me just yesterday, "I feel like you're a football field away from me," and we were sitting across from one another. So there's this distorted experience of not really living in the here and now any longer.
You worked with folks after Sandy Hook. So I'm just, you know, in comparison, it's a school shooting, but it was,
yes,
it was different because it was young kids. But as you are going to work with people, you know, at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, I mean, what are some of the interesting factors people need to be thinking about, you know, in a school shooting sort of scenario compared to something like, because you also worked with folks after 9/11, which mm-hmm. is a very different thing. Mm-hmm.
And also, I would add to that personal trauma, which can happen to an individual at any time. They're all a little bit unique. I think that when we are in a situation where we are traumatized at work and then are asked to return to that same location and perform in the same way, that is extraordinarily difficult. And I have such respect for the staff and both at the Sandy Hook Elementary School and Marjory Stoneman. What they do for their students is remarkable. But that is an extraordinarily stressful request to be made of a human being. And to go in and to perform in the way that you once did. I know that, you know, nothing is the same. The children, the students, are traumatized. They are being asked to come back to school and do very similarly as the teachers are, and that is very challenging. And so everyone is learning to find their new footing, and how can these students learn? How can these teachers be effective in educating traumatized students? It's a new world.
And how can they do that? What are some of the things that you hope to be telling teachers and staff when you talk to them this Saturday?
First and foremost is you've got to take care of yourself, right? So trauma creates what we call dysregulation in the brain, meaning, you know, our whole body and brain operates on rhythms, on electrical impulses, but particularly the brain. And trauma creates dysregulation in that rhythm. And that can show up as signs of anxiety, discomfort, edginess, irritability. In students, you know, depending on the age and the, you know, the developmental level, they may regress. So they may be chronologically 15 years old, but maybe presenting more as an 11-year-old. So understanding that piece. Behaviors change. Learning to look at physical signs, behavioral signs, emotional, and then cognitive. It's harder to focus after trauma. They may be checking out that dissociation that I talked about, so physically present but not really there. Emotionally, they may really be struggling to deal with what they're experiencing.
You know what? I wanted to jump in, and
sure.
I was thinking of, you know, one of the challenges, obviously, is everyone's got to go back to the same location. They're not going back into that building. That building is going to be destroyed, but they're back on campus. And so I'm wondering about triggers. What are some of the triggers that you have to watch for, not just in students, but in staff, as they get back to school and all of a sudden you're walking down that hallway, your friend, one of the victims, will always walk down with you. Or, you know, that teacher you're not going to see again, you pass by the office. What are some of the other triggers that you have to watch for?
I would say that's even, it starts first thing in the morning when they get up, when they start the morning routine that they've always had. We are doing the things that we always did, but life is very different. So just getting out of the bed in the morning could be a struggle. Driving to school on your normal commute, approaching the school, any of these things along the way could potentially trigger and bring up emotion. I wanted to also clarify, using the word trigger is really something we use in the context of someone who's traumatized. Reminders are different. Are there reminders everywhere? Yes. Might they be emotional from time to time? Certainly. But a trigger activates a person in a very uncomfortable, unpleasant way. Another piece to this are anniversary reactions. This return to school that's happening for them is very much like an anniversary reaction. Anniversary reactions occur when we are approaching something. Usually it's a particular date, but in this case with a school shooting, the return to school acts as an anniversary. And so there is an increase in emotional distress at the thought of returning, at the knowing what they are going to be required to do, and an increase in emotional distress, an increase of all symptoms, even if they've started to quiet down a bit, are likely to increase until they're back in school and back into the rhythm of being in school again.
We're talking with Deb Delvecchio Scully, a professional counselor focused on communal trauma. Scully worked with victims from 9/11 and the shootings at Newtown Elementary School. She'll be giving a free workshop to South Florida therapists and staff at Marjory Stoneman Douglas this Friday and Saturday. She's joining us via Skype. One of the other questions, too, as we talk about, because you're going to be talking with therapists as well, is not just any therapist can work with people who are dealing with trauma, especially communal trauma. You need certain types of training, right?
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's an ethical and moral mandate to have appropriate training. Trauma is a specialty like many other things. It's very complex. And these are probably the most complex types of traumas that therapists are going to be asked to treat. So yes, absolutely need advanced training.
If you're a patient, how do you know if a therapist is qualified to treat the kind of trauma that you're coming in with right now?
So many of us use online this online program called Psychology Today, and we have listings there. You have the ability
to email. It's kind of like the Craigslist for therapists and psychologists.
Yeah, kind of. A little bit better than Craigslist.
Okay.
But
okay.
Yes, yeah. It works the same way. You have the ability to email and to call the therapist, and I absolutely encourage people to do that. Ask questions. Are you trained in treating trauma? How are you trained? What type of training do you have? How long have you been doing this? Because a very experienced therapist of, you know, decades of experience, but who's never treated trauma, that's not the person who's best to help somebody who's highly traumatized. So you really, I really encourage people to be assertive in asking those questions. A good therapist is not going to be offended by that and wants you to have the right therapist to help you the best.
And you're going to be dealing not just with therapists, you're going to be dealing with teachers and staff.
Yes.
Because part of it is they are going to need help, but part of it is going to be they need to know, again, how to help their students. So what is it that you want to help them, teach them, perhaps, you know, as they get ready for classes?
Well, I think it begins with how they're going to take care of themselves. And So some of what we will go over, I have a list in front of me of about 20 what I call my brain reset skills, and we'll be going through all of these skills. Some of these are quick that you can do in the moment. Some of them take a little bit longer. But this is a shared experience. And everyone in the room, whether it's a student or it's a teacher or some other employee in the school, has to own their responsibility for caring for themselves. When we do that, we can then help others. So they're going to have tools. They're going to be able to share those tools with their students and hopefully help them feel much more confident to be able to do that.
And, you know, I hear the phrase self-care used in a lot of settings, and I actually don't entirely understand what that means. What does it mean to take care of yourself around this kind of trauma?
Yes. So I think that's a term that's really overused a bit and can be watered down. You know, this isn't going for a pedicure. I love a good pedicure, but we're really talking more about care of the soul. These wounds go very deep, and we need to honor that. You need to rest more. You need to eat healthy. You need to exercise, to rely on your supports around you, to prioritize self-compassion as the ultimate act of self-care. And from that more centered place, you can then be available to students, to loved ones, and be able to have that work-life balance.
We are just barely a month away from the start of school, but I'd imagine when we get to February and you get near the anniversary of the tragedy, talk to us about anniversary reaction and how that may play out.
Yeah. So in anticipation of the first anniversary, I would expect that everyone will break for winter break at the end of the year. And as soon as school resumes, there'll be a buildup of anticipation, of thinking about things, remembering things around that period of time. There will be an increase in intensity, and sometimes I think there's even an increase in fear when something as public as this occurs. Unfortunately, it can be a target for more unwanted attention. And so that's a real true fear. Understanding that it's all about anticipation, reorienting, coming back to the here and now is helpful to navigate that. But it is really a normal reaction to a very abnormal situation.
One of the things, maybe I'm just trying to think of this. I mean, I come from a generation, this was never school shootings, mass shootings, that just didn't happen. I worried about, as a teenager, acne, girls, bullies, and trying to get good grades. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, at any point in treatment, do students just have to walk away? I mean, if you feel that it's too difficult to be in that classroom, to be in the building, to be on the campus, you just can't. That you just have to get away from school for a little while. You just have to stay away from the campus for a while. Is that even a possible? Is that part of the treatment or no?
Not if you're in the hands of a good therapist. Could that happen? I would say that there would be a very, very small minority with the types of treatments that are available today. We can help people quickly desensitize to the things that are causing them the most distress. And, you know, so treatments, that includes neurofeedback, EMDR or eye movement desensitization reprocessing. Brain-based treatments will bring the quickest relief. And it's so important that the general public understands. We don't want you in a situation where you're talking about this again and again and again. That's re-traumatizing. Sitting around in a group and sharing stories, not a great idea. It's re-traumatizing.
And one of the ways that we see stories shared is through social media. I mean, how much does social media affect the process of healing for somebody who's experienced trauma? How does that affect that healing trajectory in that community?
I think it absolutely can impact it in a negative way. I always have to check in and ask, is this what I'm doing? Is this good for me? Sometimes we do, there is a cost to putting ourselves out there in a public way. And there are many of the survivors are now activists and advocates for change, which is positive. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a consequence to it as well. So I would just really encourage everyone, ask themselves that question. Is this mindful? Is this feeling good to me? Is this helping me to heal? Or is this really preventing me from healing?
You know, the reactions to this trauma are going to unfold, I'd imagine, for years. But what, is there a timeline for healing after something like this?
Not really. I think there are some projections based on how people heal from other events. And with the right form of therapy, with the right, with the best support in an ideal situation, we see people starting to really improve by year two. That does not mean that they'll be completely without symptoms, but they're making that trajectory of improvement better. Now, that also is affected by who you were the day before the event occurred. So if someone already had challenging circumstances in their lives, if they had previous traumatization or previous traumatic events occur to them, their recovery is going to be more complicated. Also, think about kind of like the circles of impact. Those who were most directly impacted are going to have the most to recover from. And so there's a number of factors that influence it. You know, recently I spoke to a former teacher from the Sandy Hook School, and she really wanted me to make it clear to everybody that there is a path where people can get better faster. And that's really what I hope to focus on the most in both groups.
And what does that path look like? What does that mean?
I think it has multiple features. And so there's something we call wraparound therapy. And that means that you have several people working with you in a therapeutic way. You have a primary therapist who has experience and the expertise in treating trauma. You may also be going to the gym and working with a personal trainer. You may be getting massages. You may be using animal-assisted therapy, but you have multiple avenues of therapeutic support that you are accessing on a regular basis.
How do you get that as a patient? How do you find all of those pieces and keep them together? I mean, does insurance cover all of this? Like, how does this work in a practical way?
Sometimes it doesn't, honestly. But just as if you were in a car accident and had a broken leg, you would invest in your recovery. If you needed to go to physical therapy, you would find a way to go. I think it's a shared kind of responsibility for the individual, but also insurance, and then perhaps there might be other sources of funding. So some of these things, yes, are paid for. Some of them are not.
Let me finish with this is, you know, mass shootings have become part of our culture. And this generation talks about they are the mass shooting culture, the generation, because it's just something that's happening so often. So do you see this kind of trauma training just becoming standard perhaps in schools? Should it be?
What do you mean by trauma training?
Well, I guess the everything that you've talked about when it comes to helping staff, helping students, but also getting therapists, training them in understanding the communal trauma and how to handle it, because unfortunately, we're probably going to see this again.
I agree with you. We probably will until major things happen in this country. Unfortunately, I also believe that whether you're a therapist or a school administrator, you have a lot on your plate and don't really think about what you need to be training for if it isn't already occurring. So for me, I'm a trauma therapist. My entire career, I have been a trauma therapist. It was just something that evolved even before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. It's been my interest. For someone who doesn't have an interest, I don't see that as being realistic that they're suddenly going to prepare. More importantly is prevention. Whatever efforts can be put into preventing further events from occurring. And that, I think, is the responsibility of every therapist, but every human being. We have a responsibility to reach out to people who are disenfranchised, to a student that doesn't fit in very well, or someone else who just might be struggling.
Yeah.
We all have that responsibility.
We've been talking with Deb DelVecchio Scully, a professional counselor focused on communal trauma. She's going to be giving a free workshop to South Florida therapists and staff at Marjory Stoneman Douglas this Friday and Saturday. She was joining us via Skype. DelVecchio Scully, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And we will have more information, by the way, on those workshops. Just follow us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Also want to thank WLRN health reporter Sammy Mack. Thanks so much, Sammy.
Thanks, Lewis.
All right, still to come, Miami has a venom response team. With budget cuts, what could that mean for people who need emergency care? More on that coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, summer's known to be the peak season for snake bites. A special unit at Miami-Dade Fire Rescue helps prevent such bites from becoming fatal. The Venom Response Team specializes in treating venomous bites, not just here in South Florida, but across the country. The 24/7 unit rushes medications to victims and works with hospitals to administer anti-venoms. It recently responded to two bites in Michigan. The two-person team is unique because it has regular access to special anti-venoms that are in limited supply in most of the country. But the fire department is going to be cutting back the unit's operations. Well, joining us now in studio is Lieutenant Scott Mullen. He's been with the Venom Response Team for almost its full 20 years, but Mullen will be leaving soon because, again, of these cutbacks. Lieutenant Mullen, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I want to clarify because I did say earlier, and I know that I'd read it, but let's clear this up. There are cuts coming, but what are the cuts and why?
The terminology is actually restructuring.
Okay.
They're going to be taken right now. You say correctly, we're a 24/7 unit staffed with one person per shift. I work a 24-hour shift. I start 7 in the morning, work till the next day, 7 a.m. And right at this point, the director wants to restructure the unit and take my position and the other lieutenant position off and just have one person on a 40-hour week, our captain, running the unit.
There's a risk to that, though, isn't there? Because, I mean, snake bites, venomous bites don't happen on a 40-hour work week, right? They happen when they happen.
Correct. I mean, that's why we do risk-reward. I'm sure the director's looked at that and thought about it, and he has a plan. I haven't had a chance to talk to him to get exactly why we're doing this. In the past, when they've tried to restructure us, it has been budget issues. I do know that there's no endless pot of gold. So, if a fire truck's got to be cut or a venom unit's going to be cut, it's going to be the venom unit.
So this Venom Response Team has been around for 20 years. This is the 20th year. Why did a national Venom Response Program get started in Miami-Dade County?
It was interesting. As many stories as we have, the first story to start it was in 1998. A gentleman was bitten by a black mamba down in South Dade.
Which is not native, I don't think, right?
It isn't. It's okay. From Africa. but that's part of this man's business. A lot of these animals, these venomous snakes, are imported for zoos, private collections, and research. In this case, the gentleman had it as a private collection, and he was bitten by it. Miami-Dade received the phone call for that bite, and along with 12 other agencies, urgently started searching for the antivenom to treat that. This is not a medicine that is made here in the United States, obviously. This is a foreign snake, so there's no FDA-approved medication, so a hospital couldn't keep this medication. Only zoos with a special license can keep it, and us. And that's the license we have. So a young Lieutenant Al Cruz working in Sweetwater, heard the call go out. He had worked with snakes. He'd worked with Bill Haas back at the Serpentarium when he was younger. He knew someone that had the medicine on hand. He went and was able to get that medicine. They were able to save that man's life. And a spark went off in his head, and he said, hey, let me look into this. How many of these bites are we getting where you don't know about? And he formed the unit, and that was in 1998, in July of 1998. I think that year they had 6 bites here. Steadily it's grown till now our total count's over 1,600 venomous bites that we've treated in the unit in the past 20 years.
By the way, let me back up a second here because you say black mamba. For those of us who don't know snakes, a lot of times when we talk about snakes here, by the way, we talk about pythons.
Right.
But
we deal with those too.
Obviously, we get a lot of different snakes here. Black mamba, what? It's not from here.
That's a snake they used in that movie Kill Bill.
Okay.
And yes, it's very deadly. The venom has a component in it. It's going to go in there and destroy tissues. It's going to destroy blood cells. It's going to start attacking neurologically. So it's a combination of that. So time is tissue. With any of these bites, a venom is actually a poison that's been injected. And once that gets into your body, the only thing that's going to stop it is the antivenom. So the longer it's in there, the more damage is being done. The faster we can get there, get the antivenom on board, the faster we can stop the effects of that venom from doing further damage. We can't reverse the damage that's been done, but we can stop further damage. And half the battle a lot of times with these exotic bites is just convincing the doctor, yes, he was bitten by a black mamba, and yes, this medicine right here is all you have to treat it. You know, it's not something you really covered in medical school too much. I mean, even toxicologists, very little is taught to them about specifically snake bites because it's a small percentage of what they do. But that's where our unit comes in and helps because we're working with our medical director, Dr. Ben Albo, who has worked with it, and Miami-Dade Poison Control, Dr. Bernstein. We come and we're the eyes and ears for them in the ER. So when I go to a bite, I'll go there and I'll look at the signs and symptoms. I can identify the snake. I don't need you to bring the snake to the hospital, but sometimes it happens. I wish they wouldn't because I've actually almost had a nurse bitten because the guy walked in holding a water moccasin and thrusted it in her face before he passed out. So, you know, we can go in there, and a lot of times we'll get bites that are not venomous. They're garden snakes. There's over 47 species of snake here in Florida.
I'd imagine you've seen everything, right?
Yes.
You've seen every snake.
Oh, that's what's awesome about this job.
And by the way, how many times have you been bitten?
By venomous, zero.
Okay.
But by non-venomous, a lot. Matter of fact, I was bitten in the face by an 11-foot Burmese python by mistake because I was feeding him, and I had looked away, and I looked back, and he saw my heat signature because they have pits in their face like a rattlesnake, and I got a face full of snakes, so that was not fun.
All right. Now I'm picturing that. Okay. Venomous snakes in Florida, I mean, I'd been reading that a lot of the bites – especially the dangerous bites, we tend to see in just a couple of states, really. And Florida's really high on this list.
Florida and Texas are the two biggest. You know, they average, the CDC says, about 5,000 to 6,000 bites a year from venomous snakes. But luckily, with medical treatment and availability of antivenom, we have maybe 5 to 6 deaths. Knock on wood, our unit in 20 years has had 0 deaths. And we've treated everything from black mambas to taipans. We've treated the king cobra bites. We've treated the stuff that you wouldn't think anyone would survive from, and had success. So it's a real testament to the men and women of the unit that put the time in to get the special train to do it.
Where are these happening? I can understand, like, Florida is a lot of swamp and Everglades. Is it people going on trail hikes that are out there by the Everglades? That's where they're getting bit mostly?
Well, we cover over 18 hospitals here in Dade and Broward. We'll go up as far as West Palm Beach for a bite and down to the Keys if we have it. A lot of the bites from our native venomous snakes, which is the water moccasin, also known as cottonmouth, eastern diamondback, pygmy rattlesnake, and the coral snakes, happen typically west of Chrome, out west towards the Everglades, and out west of I-75 up in Broward. A lot of those areas still have like kind of water reserves and stuff, which are beautiful, but they also harbor the water moccasins. A lot of people still have no idea that we have venomous snakes here in South Florida. A lot of people are like LeBron James. They think Miami's just South Beach. They don't realize it's almost 2,400 square miles of area, and that's not all land.
Right.
So, you know, having special operations like our unit, and I'm based out right now of Air Rescue South, so that allows me to jump on the helicopter to save a life.
This program, this response team is really unique, not just here in the area, but the whole country. I'm just curious how nobody else has duplicated this, or why, how in the world, you had calls from Michigan. I mean, how do you respond to help people in other places, and I'm wondering what kind of calls you're getting.
Well, that's true. We had a cobra bite in Michigan about a week and a half ago, and then I guess a few days later, we had actually a Gaboon viper bite in Michigan. So it's kind of like that Kevin Costner movie where if you build it, they will come. You know, our reputation has gotten out there, and we're seen as a resource. I had a phone call one time from an Animal Planet crew that was doing expose in Thailand, and the producer was bitten by a cobra, and they called us from an illegal shipment. They called us to see where they could get the antivenom, which I said, luckily for you, it's in Thailand, right where you are. So they called halfway around the world to find out the medicine they needed was right where they were. So that's, you know,
you guys have every kind of antivenom, right?
We keep over 50 different antivenoms. Three of them are FDA approved, and they're used for our snakes here in South Florida and the black widow, which is also, we have a brown widow here.
The spider.
Yeah. Yes. So we have those. The others are all exotics. And we did help this year to start a sister unit up at Lake County Fire Department, and they're called Venom 2, actually. And they're treating our native bites, and they assist us. You know, if they get it like an exotic, remember they had that cobra loose in Orlando. If they had a bite from that, we could ship up antivenom, and they could utilize our antivenom to treat the bites.
Where are you getting all these antivenoms? Because as you said, some of them are only made in other countries.
Correct. So we'll get them from India, from China, from Australia, from Central South America, Costa Rica, Mexico, Brazil.
And then are you guys the ones administering it, or you're taking it to a hospital, to a doctor?
No, we always treat in the hospital, because you can have adverse reactions to the body. These are foreign proteins. They're made utilizing venom that's injected into, most of the time, horses that build up an immunity, and then the horse blood is drawn out, it's cleaned up, it's turned into an antivenom that's then we utilize. Sometimes people have reactions to that, so we always administer it in the hospital, and we physically don't. The doctors and the nurses do it, but we stay there, kind of hold hands, tell them how to reconstitute it. I explain to the patient what's going on. I explain to the family, because a lot of times the family's over in the corner, terrified to ask any questions. The doctor and the nurses don't have time to talk to them, so I'll go, and you know, they're also a victim in this. You know, they're freaking out, so I'll go and say, "This is what's happening. This is what we're going to do."
I just want to mention, by the way, I'm talking with Lieutenant Scott Mullen of Miami-Dade Fire Rescue Venom Response Team. This unit has special access to anti-venom medications to respond to snake bites, not just here, but across the country, around the world, as he just mentioned. All right, so, you know, you're going to have these cuts, and so I'm just thinking as a person...
Restructuring.
My apologies. Thank you. If I get bitten by something now, so what am I going to do? Who do I call?
You always call 911. We've trained all our paramedics from here all the way up to Broward on how to treat snake bites in the field to get you to the hospital safely. So the best thing, if you can, is call 911, let the medics come to you. They're going to bring you to the hospital. I suppose during the week when it's this captain's on duty, he'll probably grab the proper antivenom and meet you at the hospital. That's what we used to do. If it's after hours, they're going to utilize EMS captains to run the antivenom up to you and help administer.
Is there a concern that... Because you just mentioned a little while ago about how many calls you're getting every year. So, I mean, if you've got this restructuring, is there a concern that maybe getting that antivenom to somebody is going to be a little bit tougher and, well, you know, that could lead to something terrible?
It's hard to treat emergencies on a 40-hour work week. And emergencies don't happen during business hours all the time. And that's why we had the fire service. That's why you can pick up your phone in Dade County, call 911, and there'll be a fire truck or a rescue truck at your door within 4 to 6 minutes. I mean, that's, you travel around the world, that's phenomenal. We're always going to take care of you. This is going to put a little bit of a delay possibly into it, and that's the part that I feel bad about, because I know when I'm on duty, I'm going to jump up, I'm going to grab the proper antivenom, I'm going to get there as fast as I can. Like I said, sometimes utilizing even air rescue because of the traffic and that. And it helps because I've seen so many bites. So that experience, that 20 years of doing this, it's hard to teach that to someone just in, you know, a month or so.
What's it going to be like for you leaving this unit?
It's bittersweet. I got on the fire department to be a firefighter paramedic, and I love that. I'm going to go back to my truck. I'm going to start running my calls. I'm going to still help people because that's why I got into this. No one gets into the fire service for the money or you know, we do it because we actually care. And so to still be able to go out and help people, that would be a blessing. The downside is that I really get to know the people. You know, usually with the fire rescue, it's the best job with someone with attention deficit disorder, because you spend maybe 5, 10, 15 minutes with a person, and then you're sending them off. You probably never see them again. With these bites, I'll take I go to the hospital, I meet you in the ER. I start with the doctors treating you there, and I wait till I can get you up to the ICU so I can go through it with all the nurses up there and let them know what to expect. So I really become have a lot of lifelong friends because of this, as you can imagine. And the animals I get to see, you know, on my days off, or the calls I get, because we're not treating snake bites. We don't sit around just waiting for snake bites. We'll go out and do the python captures, the ones that are sneaking into the neighborhoods, eating the pets. I've caught cutamondes, kinkajous, giant African porcupines, monkeys. That part I will miss, because I enjoy that and the characters that I run into.
Lieutenant Scott Mullen of the Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, he's leaving the Venom response team.
But always will be.
He's still doing his thing. And again, they're doing a restructuring, so we're just going to see that hopefully people are still going to be able to get anti-venoms if that's the case. I'm going to continue to respect nature from a distance, though.
Don't play with snakes. You won't be a victim.
Trust me, I don't. Lieutenant Mullen, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.